Well, good afternoon, everyone. Hopefully the show has been treating you well so far. My session today is on trustworthy cloud. Now, there may be a lot of different ideas of what that means to you, and hopefully I can address some of the concerns and issues associated with what trustworthiness is for cloud computing. I really won't be spending any time doing any code snippets or code review, so if you're expecting a very technical session, this probably isn't the one for you. I will stay much more in the business area of this problem space, discuss some issues and concerns that are known to us. Since I didn't introduce myself, my name is Frank Simmerjee. I'm a senior product marketing manager in trustworthy computing. And one of my key jobs is to think about what trustworthiness looks like for cloud computing. I spend a lot of time thinking, architecting, coming up with ideas associated with that. Published several different documentations over the past year, areas that I've heard from people like you, customers. These are concern areas. These are areas that need to be addressed. I'll talk to those documents in a little bit. Probably turn it down just a bit because I'm getting a lot of feedback. Thank you. And please stop me along the way if you have any questions. The more interactive can make this. I know you probably hear that from presenters all the time. Interrupt me, talk to me, but it never happens. So I'll just drone through these slides and just grind through right to the review slide so you can give me some kind of a fantastic review. So what are the objectives? Cover three major areas that, again, general feedback that we've received. Just kind of also give you another perspective. We have a lot of executives come to Microsoft on campus, and we have great conversations with them. Frequently, this is the same area that they tend to veer to. It's the, can I trust cloud computing for my services? What do I do with it? And I have some side anecdotal and observations to make, too, about this. In fact, I came across a piece of research just yesterday that I think is interesting to discuss. I can't cite the source since it just came across it yesterday, but at least I can talk about it briefly. So what does that look like in the market market adoptability? I did a study that I'm in the process of publishing. Two vertical studies. There are four verticals and studies in total. Two vertical studies went out last week. Two more are coming out this week. And I'll speak to those in just a bit. What are some of the things, issues, and items that you should consider when you move to the cloud? How does that look like, and what can you do to be successful, especially communicating that to management? If you're management, if you are the one making that final decision, I want to hear from you. You know, what are the things that are holding you up? Besides price, I mean, you know, cost is always an issue, but I have strong belief that security is the second and most important thing ultimately that'll make that decision successful or a failure. And especially today, this is one of the big things that tends to drive that decision. And then how can you find a trustworthy provider that actually works for you? I'd like to claim that Microsoft, we do an effective job. We work very hard to be trustworthy. And I'll talk about some of the elements associated with how we do that and how that transparency to you actually works. So the takeaway, I did want to provide you some things to take away besides me just talking about a whole bunch of really abstract concepts. One is there is a tool that I wrote about a year and a half ago that's actually a great tool to help you through the adoption process of moving potentially an on-prem into in cloud. It's, again, it takes a lot of the business problems, takes the business problems that you may face today and provides you some language and some descriptions as to what are some of the considerations to move into the cloud. If, depending on how time goes, I placed a demo right at the end of the session, so I'll actually walk through it. Now, using the tool is a very personal effort. I can do it on behalf of what I think it looks like, but it really will depend on you and your organization to actually go through this tool. That's why I'll go through the tool. It's not as exciting. It's a little bit on the boring side. But there are some interesting takeaways, and at least I can share those with you. And then talk about the considerations of shared responsibility. And this is actually a lot of area that I've spent time recently, is this concept of when you move to the cloud, does this mean that the provider suddenly takes over the responsibility of security and potentially compliance? reality, it's not. It's actually a shared element, and talk about what that looks like. And last thing is one of the efforts that we have as a company worked very aggressively towards is creating a model for assurance. It's operational security assurance modality is designed to actually help identify external threats and talk about how we actually capture and manage this information in an effective way. And I'll briefly talk about that methodology also. So again, if you have questions, stop me along the way. All right, so market trends. Next slide, there we go. So in the process of releasing two and two more reports, these market trend reports focus on four verticals. The information comes from about 12,000 surveyed anonymous users. The data actually comes from the actual backside of the tool, which I'll talk about briefly. Information that it collects is entirely anonymous. There's nothing actually being culled about anybody. It really is designed to provide you the best ability to be able to go through and provide a view into your organization. Again, I'll talk about the tool in a bit. User base is worldwide. So the four sectors that I actually explored and provided reports for, financial services, banking, public sector, healthcare, and retail organization. So how many of you here represent one of those four markets? That's it? Wow. I would expect a lot more. The good news for you is that these reports, if the two of them that aren't available will be available this week, the other two are already available and you can download it. It's current data that you can use to actually have a conversation with your executives, with your management, with your IT departments on what are some of the biggest issues that you're facing. All right, so security trends in the banking or financial sector. There are three things that I pulled out of this. The report does cover a lot more areas, but I wanted to kind of address three that I thought were actually very interesting and of noteworthiness. One is that out of the financial organizations, 38% don't have a budgeted disaster recovery plan. Somewhat alarming, about a third, just over a third. 37 of them don't use a standardized data classification methodology, and 23 of them, 23%, do not have a process for data disposal that's considered adequate. So what does that mean if you think bring those three things together? You see the fact that these organizations, their disaster recovery process doesn't adequately address the issues associated with how they can actually move that data from in-house and to properly actually dispose of. The policy and the data classification methodologies would mean that the private data could potentially be mingled in with less private data. So customer information, your banking records may not be properly segregated or managed in its proper fashion. As a result, the disposal of this may go through the same disposal process as junk mail. So that could be some concern in your industry if you happen to be in financial, in the banking industry. Now, if you happen to be in the banking industry and you're saying, this is not me, fantastic. But if it's you, it's definitely something to remember that you're not the only ones facing it. There are others. This, is, again, comes back from the survey. It's a pretty large sector of individuals that are facing this problem. Moving on to healthcare. Now, healthcare does affect every single one of us. Banking does, too. I mean, every one of us banks. But when I see these numbers, they tend to worry me because, well, you know, I go to doctors, too. Pharmacies, all that stuff. So 51% of them are not running system-wide data backups that are tested. So it's one thing to have a backup. I think many organizations and banks and pharmaceuticals and healthcare providers have backups. But is it actually being tested? I actually worked with an organization during a conversation, and I asked them the same question just to see if this information resonated. And the healthcare provider indicated that, yeah, they have an organization-wide backup system, but they haven't tested it probably in the last 12 months. It's kind of a concern. So let's stitch that to the next concern area. 31% of the same survey don't have a disaster recovery program. And then the last one is 23% of those do not have an adequate system to prevent power outages from affecting their organization. So think you're going in an emergent situation where that information may be very important to you, because maybe your life is at stage. Your life may be in a state of emergency. And if that information or location was hit by a natural disaster, will they have that information on demand? Can they get that information immediately? Because, well, you need it. Somewhat of a concern. On the government side, so public sector, we see that 45% of public sector organizations do not use data classification. I have a little anecdotal information here about this. If you think about it, we consider our government, especially the United States, really aggressive about classifying its data. But it classifies a very, very one segment of that data. You think about that ultra-high sensitive set of data that we normally think of what the government usually tries to protect. But they have a lot of data. That doesn't necessarily mean that they need to overprotect that data. There's also a flip side to this. What about data that the government currently owns that is public? If it's classified as secret, that's your money they're spending to classify public information. So take a look at public information on any site that is owned by the government. Most, I won't say all because there's exceptions, but most of these agencies have to comply with FedRAMP. Or one of the federal-based regulatory mechanisms. Now think, public data going into a data center that's FedRAMP certified. That's your money being wasted on extremely expensive security measures for very unnecessary efforts. Meanwhile, very public, very secure data that should be protected, information that does matter to you, potentially is being misclassified and being placed into the wrong stores, or the individuals are reclassifying information in the wrong capacity. In fact, data classification tends to be one of the areas where I'll talk briefly about a paper that I produced on this. It's the second generation data classification is where things tend to break down. You classify a piece of information as maybe company exclusive, hand it off to somebody else, or place it onto a SharePoint site, and because the site wasn't configured correctly to manage that data, the next person that comes and picks up that data, that file, that document, now may treat it as public data. So maybe at the first gen it was set correctly, but by the time it moves out to the second set of hands, it's now lost its classification. 40% of organizations do not have proper NDAs in place. What does that mean in the sense of security? Well, that means that these are individuals working, potentially contractors, potentially other individuals within the government entities that do not have a document in place that binds them to operate within certain parameters. This also includes rechecking and verification. Some of the elements that you would hope that at least a government agency would go through the process. It's one thing, again, if the individual works in an extremely secure sense, but what about everybody else that supports that individual? The one guy that's holding that ultra-secret data is surrounded by a whole bunch of folks that may not. And last is 33% of them do not enforce a uniform security mechanism. So now, thinking about it, 45% of data is not classified right. 40% of that, these individuals may not follow procedures or may not have binding agreements in place to control them, and 33% of them are not being enforced in any capacity to ensure that they do not move that data around. Question, love it. I might be able to hear you, I'll repeat.
Federal or nation, rather than city, state, local, tribal, because federal security
Absolutely. So the question is this, do I have data that substantiates based on federal versus city? And then the other slice, too, by the way, is whether it's U.S. and non-U.S. And to be honest with you, the answer is no. By design, this survey was done to be much more homogeneous worldwide. I think that's great information, and over time, I'm hoping to actually be able to drill into and actually be able to see that information much more at a much lower resilience level. Again, work in progress. You're welcome. And last one, retail. I'm sure in the back of your head, you're thinking of a couple of organizations out there that fit into this bill. Any of you represent the retail industry? Now, this could represent anywhere from large organization to mom and pops, right? I mean, that's the thing, is that I actually just recently went over to a friend's shop who, he runs a small furniture business in the Seattle area. And I should be showing him this because he faced this very, very specifically not so long ago. 72% of the retail organizations don't have a budgeted disaster recovery plan. So think about it. 3/4 of these retailers don't have a disaster plan in place that actually is being given money to run. It's one thing to say is, I have a disaster plan. It's another thing to actually put money into it. Right? That's one of those significance. Now, okay, second part of this is they don't have a plan to respond to the breach. So now something bad happens. Half of them don't know what to do with it. Do they go to the tape to do a restore? Because that's the best place they can go, right? It's restore off tape at that point. Oh, yeah, that's right. We don't have a disaster recovery plan, so we can't go to tape. And then role-based access. So what's the significance of the 1/3 of these organizations not using a role-based access methodology? It means that the retail, the point-of-sale device could be administered in the same capacity as the database servers on the back end. One username, one password, right? That's all you need. So I think these examples are really indicative of things that we see in the market today. And the reality is that we have respondents from the survey that shows that the behavior is perpetuated across, pretty much across the world. Yes, sir.
So one of the issues that I see in this industry specifically is that so much of the compliance regulations are at will of the interpretation of the auditor. So how do we narrow that gap down to where one organization is basically held to the same principles and level of security as another organization with a different auditor? I mean, you could have one year that goes one direction and then a different auditor the next year that goes a completely separate direction.
Now, clearly my presentation is about cloud trust, right? And you're right, there are some issues associated with auditors, but maybe there's opportunity in how you approach the problem. On-prem, you will constantly suffer the fact that the vehicles of how you do compliance may change, may shift based on who comes in and does that compliance process. But I have some recommendations and some ideas on how that could potentially be mitigated in my presentation. So give me a chance to actually cover that front, and if I miss it, bring me back, okay? Now, before I come off the doom and gloom and all this information, I wanted to share two little bits of information that's actually very encouraging. One is that we also had a SMB, a small business, medium business survey run. And a couple of things that we asked is that what are some of the adoption behaviors and what do you see as the benefit of cloud? One is extremely high percentage of these individuals that were surveyed. Now, this survey base is much smaller. We're talking about 1,000 people, but they were selected for the survey. Indicate that when you do move to the cloud, you do actually have serious benefits. Benefits such as security, privacy, and reliability. You can increase your reliability. It's something you don't have to manage at this point. It's not that server that's sitting in the closet. And I keep thinking of retail, and especially that small, mid-sized business, it's the perfect candidate. And for the rest of you that's not in SMB retail, you can leave now, because I'm going to be talking about SMB now. No? No laughs, nothing? Come on, that was funny. Yes, sir.
Is Azure PCI?
Azure, there are some elements of Azure that are PCI DSS compliant. We could talk about the details associated. It's a little bit tricky because the question of what are you trying to do when it comes to PCI compliance? Are you trying, again, we can maybe go into that question towards the end of the presentation. Yeah, that's exactly it. It gets a little bit tricky as to what you're trying to slice across. And then the other thing is cost savings. So turns out that that money that your business managers, your CFO, will actually be able to realize is take that money and actually reinvest it. And it's a good thing for you. You guys are the IT pros, most likely, that are going to be able to reap this benefit. You're going to see these opportunities because that money, which they can put into profit, I guess, but hopefully they'll reinvest it into IT. That's really the opportunity here, is that to reinvest into IT. And organizations that we have surveyed indicate the fact that that money that they'll save, they are looking to reinvest in IT. It's a good thing. So moving to the cloud, let's take a look at some issues associated with that. Today, the most realistic thing, the most approachable way of looking at this is to think about where are you as far as your IT capabilities right now? How can you improve that? And can the cloud reduce or mitigate some of those costs? So there's risk and reward to all of this activity. You see that the benefits really are scalability, agility, and flexibility. A lot of illities, potentially reduced cost. There is an exception, and I'm going to pick on one of those exceptions, is that if you think that an on-prem solution can be forklifted and moved to the cloud into something like an infrastructure as a service, as I mentioned, a study that I recently saw shows the fact that that's actually a huge loss to you. You cannot forklift your environment and just place it into an infrastructure as a service and hope to save money. You're going to lose money. You have to actually know what you're moving. So it's, again, an opportunity for you as a business to figure out what you're operating and figure out effectively what you can move into the cloud. Now, privacy, security, and reliability are things that can actually be turned into benefits. It's important that you find a cloud provider that you can work with that has the experience, has a means to show you transparency, and can discuss what that means to you when you deal with shared responsibility. As I said, you just can't forklift your product and hope that it'll just land successfully in the cloud. There is an effort that you have to go through. And that effort is this balance. There's a careful, careful balance that you have to go through. There are pieces to this, and we'll kind of go through the stack because I think that there's some real significant elements associated with this. Spent a lot of time kind of thinking about this, and I'd love to get your feedback if you think this is on track. So, try that again. So when you look at the three verticals, we have infrastructure, platform, and software as a service. One of the observations that you can make right away is an area where you will save money is the fact that you don't have to look after the host, environment, or the physical security of the site, the facilities, the building, right? Brick and mortar from on-prem to cloud really does pretty much go away. Where the split starts becoming a little bit less clear and where you have to really consider what your opportunities are is when you start thinking about network control, application level based controls, identity and access management. Now, clearly, I'm an advocate of saying that most organizations that consider software as a service is by far the most effective way to mitigate your risks. So thinking about looking at partners that can provide you a solution that actually is offsetting that particular issue that you're currently dealing with. That point of sale environment, heck, Office, O365 is an end-to-end solution. It really eliminates the need for you to have to manage any of those items associated with the application, with the networks, host, and physical elements. It really does deliver those capabilities. And in fact, one of the other things that it actually does very effectively is deliver a shared risk element, which has to do with identity and access management. O365 has a lot of those capabilities built in, really well-balanced solution if implemented correctly. Again, if you expect just to deliver, turn it on, all of a sudden, hey, look at this. My problem's gone away. I don't have to manage my Exchange server anymore. Odds are you're going to fail. But there are ways to implement O365 successfully. And I believe that there is a Office 365 compliance and security session coming up, I think, right after my session. If not, it's coming up first thing in the morning. So I consider looking at that if you're looking at O365 seriously, because that responsibility is something you need to consider. Platform as a service is by far one of the areas that I think over a long period of time we're going to see most of our capabilities, most of your jobs, maybe in time, move to. Why? Because one, you don't have to look after that infrastructure element. Those servers become irrelevant to you. You don't need to worry about network fiber. You don't need to worry about virtualization. You start thinking more about applications and solutions and services. When's the last time you had an executive say, "I want a server"? Maybe what they, those are the words they may have used, but they're actually saying, I need to communicate with somebody, right? It's a service they're looking for, or they need to manage some kind of data at the end of the day. That's really what they're looking for. So my suspicion is that if you haven't started becoming more familiar with platform as a service in your world, in your industry, this is a great place to start becoming very, very well acquainted. In the long run, the industry will become much more dependent for good and bad on in this market space. Now, one of the benefits too is that it does reduce, not eliminate, security issues. It does allow to shift a lot of those security concerns that you traditionally have to deal with on-prem currently. Now, in that journey to moving to the cloud, it's the same journey that you face on-prem. One is securely developing code. Now, if you buy something that's a solution, odds are you don't have to do a lot of dev worry about this. But you build anything in-house. I guess what I should say is anybody not develop anything in-house? See? Nobody raised their hands. I knew that would happen. Every one of you, I'm sure, is developing something in-house. You must consider secure development in that effort. It has to be in your DNA. It is in our DNA. Not optional anymore, because the attackers, bad guys out there, they know the entry points. They know the weaknesses of your organization through weak code development. And you think, oh, it's just a little script I just wrote. It's just maintaining an FTP server on my site. I don't need to worry about secure development. It's not true. Doesn't matter what you own, doesn't matter what you develop, you have to consider secure development. I believe recently there have been some high-profile exploits in the open source community that had to do with something very, very simple. It was a bound checking issue. Secure development reduces, doesn't eliminate, but reduces those risks considerably. Recently, Microsoft Secure Development Lifecycle has been adopted in the ISO 27034 standard, so it's now ISO-based, and addresses 17 key areas that you should consider, everywhere from the training all the way to release and response. You know, this comes back to one of those things I showed you in the earlier slides about response. Sometimes it's overlooked. How do you respond to something? It doesn't mean how do you let the world know that you've had a problem, but how do you respond to it by what's your remediation steps? How do you remediate that problem? How do you move into the next stage of evolution of fixing that issue? Now, cloud services, especially in a DevOps world, I think most of you have been able to realize that the rapidity, how rapidly you can actually deploy fixes does save cycles, which is a huge benefit. But it also has its risks, because that means less testing is executed. A couple of tools that I should mention if you haven't been familiar with SDL, such as threat modeling. Microsoft offers a free threat modeling tool. We just revved it recently. It's a great tool. Probably takes a day or two to learn how to use. But if you're in any role associated with development capabilities, even if you're not directly responsible, download the tool, play with it, and take a look at your app. Because what it'll do is it'll show you some very basic things to think about when it comes to boundaries, making sure that bad guys on the outside stay out, make sure your stuff stays in. Follows very basic principles. It's a free tool. Again, I mean free tool. Free is such a great thing these days. Oh, and no adware included. Next item that I wanted to share, as I said, this comes back to that shared responsibility role, is that About 7 months ago, one of the things that I was being asked frequently about is issues associated with data classification. So I put together a relatively slim document. It doesn't cover all the bases, but it at least gives organizations, especially SMBs, an entry point into understanding what you need to do for some rudimentary data classification efforts. This can be implemented by anybody. It really is designed to be something that you can use today very quickly. And again, what's the benefit is this will help you understand what you can move to the cloud and what maybe you need to reconsider. Two terminology models that are inside the document. These terminology models were, when I did some research, I discovered these were by far the most commonly used by industry. Ironically, healthcare and education, academics, used the restricted, sensitive, unrestricted. And keeping in mind that low-risk content, by far, it's probably the most, it's one of those great places to consider starting out with. Can that information be moved into more of a public cloud environment? Odds are it's yes, because you don't have to apply the same levels of security rigor to it. So what can you do to that more sensitive data? You can still move it to the cloud, but consider some additional capabilities. A lot of cloud capable solutions down at the floor that I've actually been talking to, they have some great solutions that they can offer. Everything from RMS, risk management services, encryption gateways. I'll pick out one partner that we work with who offers this whole concept of encryption gateway with DLP blended in called Vaultive. I'm not picking on them just because I like them a lot, but they just happen to be a top of mind. One of the things that they've done is they've actually taken our O365 solution and they've added that layer that a lot of organizations say is, okay, I trust you guys, I trust Microsoft, but I still am looking for that extra level of third-party support or another element associated with that. Vaultive offers that gatewaying of the data without having to clog up your network. Because I have a feeling a lot of organizations are thinking, O365, you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to bring all that O365 traffic through my VPN, encrypt it on site, and then push it back out. So all you've done is you've just bottlenecked your traffic. You've taken the internet and now you've brought it down to your network. Not really a good solution. So why not look at solutions that provide you the ability to actually place that encrypted data out into the cloud, just like everything else. Encrypted data in the cloud is encrypted data. Reduces the risk of that information being disclosed or accessed in an inappropriate manner. For transparency's sake, one of the things that we bring up and worth discussing at this point is working with organizations that actually strive to create transparency to the industry. Cloud Security Alliance has been around for 6 years now, 5 years. They're a not-for-profit. Microsoft is an organization that works deeply with this organization. Why? Because what they do is they bring this transparency opportunity for us to be able to work with industry leaders. Now, good news is that Amazon's there, Google's there, Verizon's there, EMC. The big players in the cloud service provisioning have become members of CSA. The value of that is the fact that it's a place to land in a collective environment. So if you're trying to understand what is the best and most effective way, and you don't trust any one of the vendors because you want to find somebody that's independent of that, take a look at the Cloud Security Alliance. And the reason I bring this up because of the next slide. So the question is, what are the areas that if you were to consider for control that you should address? Cloud Security Alliance created a control matrix called the Cloud Control Matrix. It's actually 103 control areas. Out of those 103, I actually am just showing you 27. But odds are that if you can address these control areas, and how auditors will approach this, is the more effectively that you can talk about where you stand with these controls, odds are your auditors will also walk away happy. And it doesn't matter which regulatory or which compliance body that you're trying to address, these controls are called out by virtually all regulatory environments. Now, I'd recommend taking a look at the full 100, not just the subset. In fact, CCM has evolved into a new version, CCM 3.0, lots of letters, lots of numbers. What they've done is they've added some control elements for mobile, so that if you're looking at how does mobile fit into my ecosystem, they've actually included some of that. And they've also placed some control areas associated with the concept of brokerage. So Microsoft is a cloud service provider. So is Google. So is Amazon. What happens when you find a partner, a third-party partner, that builds upon them and provides you a software as a service? In a sense, now, that third-party provider has become a broker because they're actually passing that communication back up to Azure, for instance. You, as a user, you're actually consuming that product. How does that relationship look like? How does it look like upstream? So some of that language has actually been considered and actually discussed extensively within the CSA community. So the Cloud Security Readiness Tool, which I mentioned earlier, is a tool that's freely available, addresses those 27 controls based on a maturity state. You go through the questionnaire, it asks you a maturity model-based question, as in you're on the left side, the most basic, on the right side, the most dynamic, most advanced. For each one of the controls, it does the where are you today, and then provides you some recommendations on where you could be tomorrow. So it looks at current issues, improvements, what cloud could do to accelerate your adoption. And last thing is it provides a little bit of insight into how you meet compliance requirements. Doesn't answer all your questions, but it will help you along that path. The report will actually give you a drop-down and match up based on the particular compliance requirements that you're trying to meet. So PCI, for instance, if you select PCI, it will actually, based on those 27 questions, give you the output as to what the PCI requirement is for that control. So controls such as antivirus is one of the control areas. Do you have an anti-malware antivirus set up, and how mature is it? Well, PCI DSS has some very specific language as to what you have to have in place. The report that this tool generates will actually give you some of that insight. Oh, did I mention it's free? You know, it used to be that free was the biggest thing. It's like, oh yeah, I get it for free, but now I guess it doesn't mean that much. Oh, another thing, it's product agnostic. Doesn't matter if you are moving to a Microsoft product or to a non-Microsoft product, the report will work for you regardless of those scenarios. Absolutely, at the end. So you see, I'm going to keep you. I'm not going to let you walk out on me. I'm going to tell you at the end. All right, maybe that's not such a good idea. Experience and transparency is the last area that I wanted to discuss briefly, and that has to do with what does building a trustworthy cloud look like? To us, anyway, to Microsoft, it means having a cybersecurity solution that actually is effective, privacy capabilities that are there for individuals, and compliance methodologies that are applicable to all organizations. You see this through transparency of activities like secure development, privacy by design, and operational security assurance. And let me talk about those briefly. Before I move on, though, I wanted to make one little acknowledgement. This last week, we released our 16th edition of the Security Intelligence Report. Now, if you're looking to see what are the cyber threats in the landscape, this report is also free. It's really big, and it also is geo-specific. So if you have some geo-specific issues that you're looking to find out, especially in cyber threat issues, this report is one I would strongly recommend to download. So now that I've pimped that, moving on to back to SDL. I mentioned earlier, you should consider SDL if you haven't already considered it and you're not using it, how we apply it. Microsoft, we see the fact that SDL has to be in our DNA, which it is. It's best practices and learned activities. product development, not just product development of our current products that you're familiar with that we ship, but also our cloud solutions have to abide to secure development capabilities. We have to conform to the same capabilities that we would recommend anybody else conforming to. Testing methodologies, and we do this through several groups. We have groups that represent all of these businesses to really reduce the threat horizon for our products and our cloud solutions. So incident response, secure design, we have a team that's associated with that. Implementation, verification, all these key roles are things that we think are extremely essential for us to be a good cloud provider. As I mentioned, for us to actually be able to provision these cloud solutions, we have to do it in a fashion that we can actually demonstrable behavior. And then one of the things that became clear in this effort is SDL is great when it comes to secure development of software. The development lifecycle of software is meant for SDL. DevOps introduced some new problems. And what Microsoft did to try to address this and has actively been working with is to look at a methodology for operationalizing secure development. It addresses the issues of scalability, addresses the issues of standards and bringing the standards into the environment, primarily focuses on internet-based threats. And there's a lot of threats internal and all kinds of different mechanisms where threats can actually occur, but the operational security design is designed to really focus on those external threats, the highest risk threats that we as an organization face, especially when we provision for you, and the fact that it can continuously be updated. So how does that methodology look? Well, it's a model designed to be based on the highest quality of service, which is where we want to place you as our customers, with services that are secure, requirements across different products, different issues, FISMA, FERPA, HIPAA, PCI, consolidated requirements, address it once, comply many. As an organization, Microsoft has been striving to be able to provide our partners, our users, everybody that looks at our products, that capability. So it's a transference of our compliance capability. So you as a consumer, you as potentially a broker building a product on top of us, can look to us as that first step of compliance. It's risk transference. You can transfer some of those risk issues to our governance model. And then obviously this is built on this structure of a continuous model and secure development capability. The methodology does take all of these different types of inputs. The team that is responsible for this is working diligently to make this available across the organization. It's everybody is to comply, everybody is to go through this process of operating securely. So bringing that concept of DevOps. When I first heard that, I was like, oh, God, such a terrible thing to be saying, DevOps. You know, either you're developing or you're operating. But, you know, we're seeing more and more of this principle of taking code that may be very, very young and dropping it into an operational environment. At what point do you see your live data, your actual live data, being treated like test data? That's what DevOps really does. And you know, there are several regulatory bodies that do not permit for that. HIPAA and FISMA actually have language built in to state that dev and test are supposed to be segregated and separated. Problems that aren't entirely solved, but things to consider in your organization too. To use live data in a test environment probably violates some level of compliance. But in that process, you continue striving towards certifications and attestations. Microsoft, Azure, and O365, Dynamics, and Intune has gone through these different regulatory capabilities and can extend those to you, obviously, every time you use our product. So the one question was about PCI DSS. Yeah, so when it comes to placing a product into our Azure environment, when it comes to transactions and transaction record management, I believe that you do require to work with one of our partners that does PCI DSS storage of data. However, we can do transactional. So the data transactional can be done through Azure. It can't be stored in Azure. And that's relatively recent. And I believe that over time, things like that are continuing through that process of becoming more and more closer to, I believe it's a tier one operator, but I don't believe that we're quite there yet. The STAR, which is part of the CSA's organization that I mentioned earlier, also offers another thing, which I think is a great place to start if you're investigating cloud providers. It's called a Security Trust Assurance Registry. It addresses those 100 questions, those 100 controls, and how does the cloud provider address those issues. It provides us some of the language and some of the understanding as to how the provider can actually meet those at a relatively high-level perspective. How does those controls meet your requirements? These reports are available to you. Currently, there's one for all our products, glad to say. I believe Amazon, AWS, has a report up there. There's some that are missing. I won't mention the other provider that doesn't have their registry information up. So before I jump into the demo, last slide here gives me just perfect amount of time to do a quick demo of a tool, is our commitment. This is something as a provider we have to be able to abide by. The basic principles are associated with being able to provide some deep knowledge and deep thought, working with law enforcement, for instance, through a digital crimes unit. These guys are dedicated to taking down botnets. Again, it's an active process of being in the community and working with organizations to protect them. What our goal within trustworthy computing is within that security, reliability, and privacy. Internally, we deal with a lot of problems. Our MSIT organization actually faces the same problems that you probably face because they consume our own product. So as a result, we get some great lessons learned from our own adoption of our cloud solutions. We are actively adopting our cloud solutions. We use O365 at Microsoft. As an employee, I'm actually using it, and I'm really happy because it does exactly what it's supposed to do. A lot of our portals, a lot of our capabilities are now moving to Azure. Again, it just shows you the fact that we can use our own products to be able to actually meet those requirements. And we have a very diverse environment, so sometimes it does make it a little bit complicated. So where is all the information that I showed you, all the tools, all the guidance? All that information can be actually downloaded from one place. I don't have to make you go to 3-4 different sites. Just go to Microsoft.com, Trusted Cloud. So now I'm going to dedicate the next 10 or so minutes to look at the Cloud Security Readiness Tool. And then I'll take questions. Actually, maybe I'll take questions first and then the tool, and then I can take some more questions. So if you have any questions, and I'll take them now, and then we'll take a look at the tool briefly. So jump up and ask me something crazy. Maybe not. Yes, sir.
I have one where our security council is pretty much a stadium. Absolutely none of our accounts will be replicated up into our Azure panel.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons why I'm sitting in this session. What kind of security practices are there? Are there any certifications on how those accounts are stored? Where do I go for that? Is Trusted Cloud the place to?
So your question has to do with the fact that can you trust those security accounts in the cloud tenant? Is that the crux of it?
Yeah, obviously we're trying to do ADFS and SSO
So now you've looked at the Azure Active Directory services as a possible solution for that. All that information, I mean, there is actually a session on Azure Active Directory Services that talks about the security implementation and capabilities of the tool. Absolutely. One of the things that I can keep stressing is that encrypted data is encrypted data. It doesn't matter if you have it in-house or if you have it in the cloud. If you have a proper key management methodology in place and you have some data classification principles in place, and I know what I'm storing where, it doesn't matter where ultimately those bits land. Now, the reluctance of management to move into that state, probably the best way to look at it is the fact that Azure has met all of these compliance requirements, and we do have all those attestations available to our customers. You just have to work through the rep that you're considering you're working with, who should be able to get you whatever vertical, what space are you in?
Construction.
So you're probably more not federal, maybe ISO 27001 probably.
It's all over the board.
Yeah. So my guess is, you know, we do have our ISO 27001 attestations, and it has a language as to how that data is stored, managed, distributed. All of that information is actually available in that attestation. And that's no different than if you execute it in on-prem. So ultimately, what you're doing is you're just shifting those potential risk elements, because ultimately, your on-prem environment could fail in other ways. Absolutely. It's happened before. Yes, sir?
Might be a bit out of scope. Has Microsoft given consideration to making as a service like SQL Server provided in Azure, PKI, you can spin up AVCS PKI, make it easier for customers?
So most of the PKI capabilities, you're right. You're right on the cusp of where I can touch. But our PKI capabilities are already available in our cloud provisioning. So Azure does offer PKI capabilities in different flavors and different elements. Rights management through our O365 also offers, it's a pretty much a built-in PKI mechanism inside of that. I'm not sure what particular items you're trying to protect. We're talking about Active Directory services, right? It also has a key structure built in. Strongly recommend that, you know, this is the thing. You turn to Microsoft for all of your solutions, including PKI. I mean, obviously, those keys need to be managed in a certain way. You need to understand what your key structure management is. Do you want it on-prem? You want it in the cloud? Do you want a different provider to manage your keys, for instance? Do you need, you know, what are those conditions? And absolutely, we do have a lot of those issues addressed, and they are actually available today. Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Leaving aside, and this is about DC. This is, well, technically it's about
D1. Okay, disaster recovery.
But I have a conundrum. Except for like websites, publicly available, high availability, perfect to go into the cloud. The things that are business continuity items to me are they're going to be absolutely my profit centers, absolutely the jewels, the crown jewels. So the thought of sending those up into the cloud infrastructure, that's the last.
As I mentioned, it's transference of risk, actually, right? So when you're dealing with these issues associated with any type of disaster recovery or business risk management, I'll share that there is a special set of data that we even at Microsoft consider high-value assets. These are assets that fit into one of three categories. Business will fail due to loss. And let's quantify that. When we say business will fail, I think that there's a lot of times you think of customer data, well, if I lose my customer data, my business will fail. In fact, actually, there's evidence more and more that you lose your customer data, it's really painful to recover, but it doesn't put you out of business. I think that there's a careful clarification to that, whether those records that are lost could put you out of business because maybe it's pre-IP data, intellectual property that's in process of being discovered. Because once it's actually been, IP data has been declared, sensitivity goes down, actually. There's very few bits of that information that you need to consider in that same capacity. Loss of life for healthcare, even there, you know, you think about, I know of scenarios where healthcare providers have placed large quantity of personal information into dumpsters. So clearly they didn't go out of business. I mean, it probably was very painful. But let's, again, be very clear, loss of life, what does that mean? Maybe if you're a government agency and you've got certain people in certain locations and that information is disclosed, that could be loss of life. Not just losing, again, records or information associated with that. Or jail time. Executives facing direct jail time, not indirect. I think we see, again, in the news all the time where you see these indirect corollary things. So-and-so is going to jail or quit his job because information was lost. Did it put the business out? Did that business actually go out of business as a result of that? No, not really. So again, what does HVA? Well, HVA is stuff that really is that end of the line. Now, you as a disaster recovery person, you can probably bring that scope down very, very quickly and identify what is that nugget. My suspicion is it's actually pretty small. There are methodologies that you can actually find and I've been actually working at defining on how you manage HVA. Can you actually place it into the cloud? My opinion, on my soapbox, this is my personal opinion, an encrypted data store is an encrypted data store. Doesn't matter if it's in the cloud or if it's underneath your desk. Once that data is encrypted and meets a certain level of requirement, I mean, obviously, 256-bit encryption may not be sufficient, maybe 1024, 2048, I mean, whatever, AES. It's encrypted data. At that point, if you place it into a provider like Amazon, like Azure, it's encrypted data. If you manage the keys in-house, for instance, for that high-value asset, now you're only having to manage keys. All of a sudden, your footprint gets much smaller. You can actually come up with a distributed model in-house where you can manage keys, place the data in the cloud, risk is pretty much eliminated. So there are methods and methodologies that can be applied. I think it's just a matter of thinking the fact that cloud provisioning is really just another form of storage. I mean, it just takes those elements away. You just need to find the one nugget that you can actually control and think of what really is necessary to control in that. I mean, as I said, with the PKI, the key management is by far one of the best and most effective ways to reduce that risk. Does it eliminate it? No. I mean, odds are that the weakness that you're going to still face are your staff. And unfortunately, encryption won't solve that. So real briefly, let me pull up the tool and walk through this. Make sure that I can here. Just bring this over. This way. All right. So you can find this off of that link the Trusted Cloud site. You can use the tool. Goes through a very basic set of questions. And earlier I mentioned, pick the regulatory environment that you may be interested in. So provide a name. This could be anonymous. You don't have to give it a real name. It's up to you. I mean, obviously, this is going to be a customized report for you, for whoever that this name is displayed here. Picking a vertical. Location. Here we're going to pick what model of infrastructure of what model that we're interested in. So if we're interested in storage versus content creation, and generally this is more for me. You're just giving me a segment as to what you're interested in. What's more interesting to you will be what kind of provisioning you're interested in. The answers for the report will vary based on which one you select. The most comprehensive set of answers will usually be the ones where you can actually shift the most risk. So I'd recommend that, as a result of that, picking software as a service, because the recommendations will be much more robust. Because in infrastructure as a service, most of the language says, you know what, you've taken this blob from here, you've moved it to there, but at the end of the day, all you've done is eliminate the physical risk. You haven't really eliminated anything else. That cloud provider is going to take a stand back, and they're not going to do anything for you. With software as a service, you're actually shifting that risk. And then pick a regulatory environment that you may be interested in. Here, I picked HIPAA, I believe. Odds are that one of these regulatory environments touches on a space that you're probably interested in. If it doesn't, let me know. I've tried to add additional regulatory elements. But they have to, obviously, I'm looking for the ones that have the largest cross-section and interest. Turns out the largest cross-section and interest for Europe is an ESA IAF, and that's not the British Standard Institute. That's actually a German organization, the BSI. They're responsible for a broad spectrum of controls in the German area. Now that you know that, now I can move on. So policy design are the first set of questions. Notice the four stages. Initially, we're asking questions associated with the first three questions all have to do with policy creation. So one is, do you have security policies in place, such as an ISMS? Are those being reviewed by management? And the last one, which is just at the bottom line here, have to do with, the review process. Yeah, update. So is a policy in place? Is management bought off on it? And is it at least looked at occasionally? Right? Those are three conditions that make a good security policy. It's not one thing just to have it. If you have a document somewhere on some shelf, it's meaningless. It's only if it's alive. Next couple of questions here have to do with background checking. You go, well, that's not really a security issue, but you know what? It actually is. It's a human resources role that they actually play in IT departments. More and more, that responsibility is one that's important to the IT department. Because if you're hiring, are you making poor hiring decisions? Odds are you end up with a situation where now the weakest link is the stuff that you have inside. And same with non-disclosure agreements. It's interesting, the language in NDAs today can vary dramatically, but a good NDA can actually help your organization be successful. Next area has to do with physical role-based access. How is those physical elements being actually protected? How are your employees' change termination process being managed? That kind of comes back to the hiring practice. Now, in your head, you're probably kind of answering these questions, and that's a good thing. Now it's an opportunity. You'll be able to go to a tool and populate this. You don't need 100% the right answer. These are tools. This tool helps you. It's about nudging you forward. It doesn't matter what role you play within your organization. It's to help you move forward, advance you in that capability. There's data destruction and recovery. What are your data destruction and recovery program that you currently have in place? Next area has to do with risk management. What kind of risk management program do you have in place? How is it being managed? And customer data. You know, this one of the things I mentioned earlier is a lot of regulatory bodies actually forbid customer data being used as test. So if you have seen that in your organization where that live data is being replicated and pulled over into a test environment, yeah, you probably are failing some kind of regulatory compliance element. Or likewise, even if you're taking a snippet of that data, you're not supposed to have those two data sets in one place. You know, in fact, actually, there's some regulatory elements in place that state that your test and ops team cannot be the same people. Guy who's operating and deploying that software shouldn't be testing it. Again, it has to do with separation of duty, making sure that that data isn't being colluded from one side to the other. Next area that ask about is resilience. Now, this is by far the area that infrastructure as a service, as an entry point, really shifts burden from on-prem. It's the whole premise that you can actually have data centers that you don't have to manage, you don't have to look after that external physical perimeter. A disaster recovery plan in its most basic sense is a resilience issue that you can actually be called out in its basic sense. I mean, there's some advanced elements associated with that that this tries to avoid. Again, basic guidance, not advanced guidance. And then security architecture. These are the ones that I think most people are very familiar with. This has to do with patching, AV, firewalls. You know, this is that rudimentary old school security. Well, most regulatory environments, most compliance capabilities require you to still adhere to that. You have to have AV solutions in place. And you know what? In the BYOD model, this hasn't gone away. It's just that it's shifted. Most folks that operate a server farm of one capacity or another, hopefully, they don't use the browser on a server. Hopefully, no one here uses a browser on a server, right? Yeah. It's kind of one of those things I think we've all accepted as a norm that you don't do. But you still have to follow some basic principles to protect that data in its adequate manner. And then that's it for the questionnaires. It downloads. We end up with a quick download here. And let's see if I can. Let's see. Oh, there we go. So you end up with this fantastic 87-page report. 87 pages, oh my God, that's a lot, isn't it? But, you know, this is, again, the opportunity to kind of go back to your organization and have deep conversations about these individual controls. So if I go down here and take a look at security policies and procedures, you see it provides you insight as to what your current state is, some recommendations, and some advantages of how a platform as a service will assist you to reduce those risk issues. And they'll go through each one of the 27 areas that we just called out. Likewise, on the flip side of that, so each page that you print up or you look at in this PDF, its partner is the regulatory body that you selected in that initial dropdown. So here's the controls associated with HIPAA high tech. If you're in the healthcare industry, for security policies, this is what you must abide by. Well, you must. You should. That doesn't necessarily mean you will. So that's it for my presentation. I have a couple of minutes here for questions. I see not everybody wanted to sit through the demo, which is perfect. That was by design. Standard disclaimer, resources and information. Obviously, if you want Xbox One, and I have mine, it's worth going in for that gift card. QR code, I'd love your feedback, your review, your ideas. And obviously, high score is always a benefit. I know most of you, it's like you walk right past those computers and go to your next session. But, you know, I will advocate that us presenters live and die by this. Any questions, comments? Otherwise, I am done. No, I guess that's it. Well, thank you very much for attending my session.